Dwa serduszka, cztery oczy, ojojoj, co płakały we dnie w nocy, ojojoj. Czarne oczka, co płaczecie, że się spotkać nie możecie, że się spotkać nie możecie. Kiedy chłopiec chorzy miły, ojojoj. I któż by miał tyle siły, ojojoj. Kamienne by serce było, żeby chłopca nie lubiło.
Welcome to the Truth to Power Show on Radio for Brooklyn. I'm your host, VGR Nathan, and this is Radio for Brooklyn. With us today is Claire Van Winkle of Rockaway Writers Workshop, our co-host.
Hello, welcome. It's good to be back after so long.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And with us today, our guest is Jacob Kruger. Jacob has worked with thousands of writers from Academy Award winners to Tony Award winners to beginning writers picking up their pen for the first time. Jacob is a WGA Paul Sullivan Award-winning screenwriter, playwright, producer, and director. Jacob's first produced movie, the Emmy Award-winning Matthew Shepard story, won him the Writers Guild of America Paul Sullivan Award and a Gemini nomination for Best Screenplay. He has collaborated in original film musicals with Tony Award-winning composers and four-time Academy Award-winning composers, as well as a full slate of solo projects ranging from feature films to TV and miniseries. Welcome, Jake.
Oh, it's so great to be here, VJ.
Thank you. So why don't we start with the evolution of the Jacob Kruger Studio and how that came to be?
Oh, well, that's a pretty amazing story. So I had no plans to be a teacher. I was first a producer and then a screenwriter. And I was very lucky. I had success very young, but never in what I planned to be doing. I always planned to be to direct theater, but somehow I ended up with this kind of awesome career as a screenwriter. And I turned 30 and I realized I was not happy. I was mostly writing for money. I was writing the projects that my agent wanted me to write, mm-hmm. as opposed to the projects that really moved me. And I was lucky to do something like the Matthew Shepard story. But I kind of reached that point in my career where it had become about success. So for my 30th birthday, I allowed myself to direct a play. I raided my savings. I took a couple of months off, and I had the best couple of months of my life. And so I moved to New York actually to direct theater, which humbled me. I had a great time, produced a bunch of stuff, but it, you know, theater, you just don't make money. And so after a couple years of not making money, I was kind of in a panic. I didn't know what I was going to do creatively. And I got a call from a, you know, kind of crappy screenwriting school saying, hey, would you like to teach a class for us? The money sucks, but it's a lot of fun. And I taught my first class, and I realized this was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And the studio actually started in my living room. I had two students, and I had three friends pretending to be students. And those two students got the ride of their lifetime because they were in a room full of professional writers. And then by word of mouth, it kind of grew over the years. We now have half a floor right by Penn Station. We have 11 faculty members, and which is really wonderful because I'm able to fill in there are areas that I know a ton about, but I'm able to bring in experts like Jerry Prezigian, who's an Emmy Award-winning showrunner to teach TV comedy, or Steve Moulton, who is a Pulitzer Prize nominee. So we have a really tremendous faculty, and what we're trying to do is kind of provide an answer to grad school, because so many people, they go to grad school, you spend $300,000, and how are you supposed to be an artist with $300,000 of debt?
Yeah, so true.
Then the hardest thing is you've got all this debt, and you're out of grad school trying to make it after the couple of years of bliss, and you don't have a support system. And so what we try to do is turn the grad school model upside down. And what we do is we offer very inexpensive screenwriting classes that really anyone can afford. And if you can't afford them, we do payment plans. And then we pair people with professional writers for one-on-one mentorship. Mm. So you get to meet every week or every other week with a professional writer, world-class professional writer, at a tiny fraction of the cost of grad school, and you basically get lifelong mentorship. And we've had tremendous success from our students, so it's kind of been a dream come true for me.
Yeah,
that's actually, I'm yet to get to the whole, like, we have a space and a floor thing for my workshop, but the workshop I run in Rockaway, our mission is to make creative writing workshops available for about the same price as a yoga class. So along the same lines of providing that accessibility without sacrificing the quality of what you're getting.
Yeah, because you want to work
really
with
important.
Artists.
Yeah, well, yeah. And also it's just more voices is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it seemed like you really followed the motto of following your bliss and such. And what are the guiding philosophies or values that really drive you forward that follow your bliss? And also, if you can expand on that and how, you've been able to just kind of forego certain values, but also certain negative things, about following money or following ambition, but rather following your bliss and how this enriched your life. Yeah.
Well, I think it's hard, Vijay, because we don't always know what's going to make us blissful.
Yeah.
We think we know. You know, what's supposed to be making me blissful is directing theater. But what turned out to make me blissful is running a screenwriting school. So, and so sometimes it's hard to know what your bliss is.
Yeah.
So the way I'm a screenwriter, so I like to think that if you learn how to live a great life, you will learn how to write a great screenplay. And if you learn how to write a great screenplay, you will learn how to live a great life. And they both boil down to a really simple thing, which is sometimes you know the big thing you want, and sometimes you don't. So if you know the big thing you want to take a step towards it. And, you know, the mistake that most people make is going all or nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to quit my job and I'm just going to write. And a lot of the people who do that.
Didn't you do that for theater?
Well, what's interesting was, yes, I did. Yeah. But I spent 8 years building up my savings. Mm-hmm. I took 2 months off. Mm-hmm. But I had projects to go back to.
Right.
And I made a choice with that. And so, yes, eventually you have to make the big choice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
invest in something.
Yeah.
You have to, if you had a flash flood, you don't get a stream, right? You mm-hmm. get a lot of water and everything washes away.
Don't tell me that. I live in Rockaway, man. That's not cool.
So, trigger warning. Yeah.
I believe you want to start with a trickle.
Yeah.
And different people have a different tolerance for risk. And so a trickle is something different for different people. But you want to start, you know, if you don't write at all right now and you quit your job, all that's going to happen is you're going to end up overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start writing for 7 minutes a day and you go, hey, this is my passion, or whatever your passion is, you want to be a ballerina, you start dancing for 7 minutes a day. You want to play the guitar, you start playing the guitar for 7 minutes a day, whatever that thing is. If you start doing that in little steps every single day, what you find is that the world starts to actually adapt to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you thought you only had 7 minutes, but soon you're writing for an hour.
Yeah.
And during that boring staff meeting, you're actually thinking about your script.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What ends up happening is you end up laying the foundation for yourself. It's these little steps that actually end up laying the foundation so that when you are ready to take the big step, you have the infrastructure, you have the artistic muscles. And the biggest thing with all art is fear. And if you haven't taken care of the fear in the little steps, it's really hard not to end up paralyzed when you take the big one.
Mm.
And so I feel like with anything in life, you want to go, what's the thing that I want right now that I absolutely know I want? If it's a tiny little thing, I want to go take a walk in the park. Well, go take a walk in the park.
Yeah.
If it's a big thing, the small always leads up to the big, and the big always leads to the small. So it's about figuring out what's the thing that's small enough for me to do right now.
You know, it's interesting because as we're talking about before the show, I'm a teacher. I teach college. And I think that there's sort of a trend among students to try to skip to the end of things. So in terms of looking at a lesson, and I kind of believe it's sort of this teaching toward testing philosophy and the idea of school being a end full of means instead of something that you use and build with. So I think it's really important to emphasize this, this starting small. And a lot of artists and writers I know get frustrated with that, because they think it's supposed to be this big, like, lifestyle right away. But, yeah, starting, building those steps and building sort of a discipline, but I like to think of it more as integrating, instead of saying discipline, integrating it into your life is a more positive way of thinking about that.
I 100% agree. The word discipline is a terrible word for artists.
Yeah.
Because most of us are rebels in some way, and so you try to discipline yourself. And you, the little artist inside of you rebels against it.
It's like self-flagellation, but with a pen.
Yeah. So I know one thing, one experiment or one program that happened was National Novel Writing Month, which is NaNoWriMo. And, you know, I participated in that a couple of years. And, you know, I got to a lot of the meetups and people were writing there. And some of the people were like, you know, at those meetups were like, you know, when we had to sit down and do some writing during the meetups, they were like, oh, what am I going to write about, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That even though they have such a strong desire to write, it's like that blank page just can be paralyzing. And telling stories and such and the importance of storytelling. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how to overcome writer's block
Just to throw in before, I kind of, my whole thing is the first step to being a writer is learning to write badly.
Yeah.
But
that's funny. I do the same thing. I believe if you want to succeed as a writer or in anything, you've got to get into the volume business. And, you know, you have to allow yourself to be a beginner. And you know, so I started basically my boss would knock on my door and say, you know, I want to make a movie about Sacagawea or whatever topic came into his head. And I had to create a story. And sometimes those ideas were good ideas and sometimes they were bad ideas. And what I learned is that, you know, producers get obsessed with ideas because they have to sell stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But once you actually start working towards as a creative, particularly as a writer, but really in any creative field, you realize like you actually have more ideas than you could write or direct or paint or whatever your thing is than you could do in a million lifetimes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, stop worrying about ideas,
mm-hmm.
Because all ideas are going to lead you to the same place. Like it does take the worst idea you have, and eventually it's going to lead you to some beautiful or broken or beautiful and broken part of yourself
mm-hmm.
that you're wrestling with and you're trying to make sense of.
Mm-hmm.
And so it almost doesn't matter what door you go through. And even on the commercial side, you can make any idea commercial. Turning something in, if that even matters to you. But turning something into a hooky, creating a hook for something is just a technique. It's just a tool. So what really matters, you know, is figuring out what the thing is, and not what's the thing that you want to say is, because honestly, it doesn't matter much what you want to say, because there's something inside of you that needs to come out regardless of what your conscious mind thinks you want to say.
Yeah. And I feel like the biggest part of, you know, people are always worried about, like, is all my style the same? But if you just think about how something makes meaning. So the idea of looking for not so much concepts or finished ideas, but just finding something with substance that evokes something. And I don't know, for my writers, sometimes that's as simple as saying, pick any object in the room and zoom in and write about it until you can't think of anything else to say, and then let that go somewhere. And usually that'll go from writing about the corner of a room to a childhood bedroom or something like that. But if you just let yourself think and let yourself explore, that's the big thing. Exploring any idea is going to lead you into a new story.
You know, Augusto Boal, the great director, who's the creator of the Theater of the Oppressed form of theater. And he said, you know, if you want to change the world, you need people to see what they look at, hear what they listen to, and feel what they experience. And the same thing is true for us as writers. We believe that we don't have voices, right? Everybody, or we believe we don't have talent. Or we think, I used to have talent, but maybe I don't have talent anymore.
I wrote that poem. Now I've forgotten how to write.
Exactly.
Yep. Every time.
Every writer struggles with that. But what we really lack is the ability to look. Yes, we have the ability, but we've been trained not to. So we see dog, but we don't see, oh, notice that that dog has hair everywhere except one little spot on his nose. Or we see, you know, funny best friend, but we don't notice that little detail. And so being a writer is about learning to look in two different places. It's about learning to look outside and literally realizing that in this tiny little room that we're in right now, there is enough inspiration for a million screenplays. But also learning to look inside and remembering that the memories that you have, the experiences that you have, if you started exploring them now, you would never run out of ideas.
And the fact that I'm also a writing therapist, and I use I research how we actually think and speak in poetics rather than in what would normally be a structure of, I mean, poetics have a grammar, but anyhow, if we look at our memories, we don't experience our memories first as words. We experience them like we experience this room. So writing about this room, unlimited inspiration. But when you think about when you have a memory, if you describe it physically in that same way, if you give a snapshot of it, then that's already something where showing, not telling, but something that allows you to get past your idea of the thing, what you think you already know, and to explore and let yourself discover something on paper, because your memory holds more than your conscious mind has processed verbally. And the page is where you can take that experience of the physical world and your experience of the story and let them come together into something new.
Also, I'm hearing here is about truth and finding our personal truth, finding our really getting in touch with our truth, or getting in touch with being true in writing. And one of the questions I was thinking about was, one of our previous guests was talking about writer as a reporter as opposed to a creator, like writers telling things, observing the reality and just reporting what it is. But it seems like we're hearing a counter narrative. And I want to expand on that a little bit more, that the writer is not seeing the world and reporting it, but rather creating it, would you say? Or what is your opinion on that? Yeah.
So it's actually a complicated question.
Yeah.
Right. And it's important to recognize that this is art.
Yeah.
And anyone who tells you that it always has to be a certain way is lying to you.
Yeah.
But there's, and screenwriting is a little bit different than novel writing or poetry.
Yeah.
Because ultimately we have to make these things. And in poetry and in novels, even in music, you can go inside. And you can go into thoughts, you can go into feelings, you can go into the inner monologue. In screenwriting, we have to externalize things. Mm-hmm. We can only actually experience what we can physically see on the screen. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a little less true once you're in production and you have incredible actors who are able to. There's a great moment in There Will Be Blood. In the original script, there's a 5-page montage where he realizes that his brother may not be who he thinks he is. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, Daniel Day-Lewis does it in one look because he's that good. And he can actually allow his interior to become exterior on his face.
Yeah.
But in screenwriting, on the page, you need that monologue because you need your that montage because you need your audience to be with you. And so as screenwriters, we're kind of translators.
Mm-hmm.
And we need a higher level of craft. I mean, all art is about craft as well. But we need a, let's not say higher, let's say different. We need a different level of craft in order to go, okay, I'm observing my emotion right now and I feel this, or I'm stepping into the character and the character feels this. And then you have to be able to translate, okay, therefore, what does the character do?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And then therefore, because the character does this, what happens on the page and how do I capture that in a visually spectacular way on the page? And, you know, there are 4 different modalities of learning. And, you know, part of being an artist is learning where you're strong and learning where you're weak. So, you know, there's kinesthetic learning, which is people feeling. And so there are some writers, and these are the writers who usually think they're bad at structure, right? Where they're kinesthetics. They feel their way through a script or through a novel or through a poem. It feels right or it feels wrong. But it may be hard for a primarily kinesthetic writer to go to an outline. In fact, for a kinesthetic writer, going to an outline might be completely wrong, or it might be something they have to do very late in the process where they have to feel, is it true or not first? An auditory writer, oftentimes those are the writers who struggle with dialogue or who struggle with action, right? They're really great. They can hear the dialogue in their head and they can feel the rhythm and they or hear the rhythm and they know if the rhythm of the scene is right or if it's clicking or not. But they may struggle to connect to the emotion of the character, or they may struggle to actually see it. And then you have visual learners, of course, who are going to see it. These are the people who think they have tin ears, right? They think that they can't write great dialogue. And of course, you have digital learners, but digital learning is interesting because nobody actually learns that way. And you were talking earlier about teaching to the test, which is why this world is so hard for artists. All the teaching is digital, right?
Not in my classroom.
That's lucky. And this is one of the interesting things about screenwriting. It's one of the reasons I wanted to build a studio is most college classes in screenwriting are not taught by screenwriters. And most books about screenwriting are not taught by screenwriters. And it's a simple economic problem, which is that screenwriters make a ton of money. And they also travel a lot for work, and it's hard to actually to keep them. You can get the retirees sometimes, but it's actually very hard to attract, and they don't need to teach. So you have a small group who wants to teach.
Right.
Whereas
you have poets saying, like, pay me, yes, I'll do anything.
You can study with any poet you want. It's incredible. Yeah. And so, you know, this...
Well, I just want to ask you, what kind of learner are you, and how does you, first let me ask that.
Well, so we all have all of them,
yeah.
Right? The truth is, I can feel, I can see, I can hear, and I can think digitally,
yeah.
Right? I can plan. It's about understanding what your primary is.
Your primary, yeah.
And if you focus, you're not a digital. I've been teaching now since 2005. I've met one primarily digital learner.
Uh-huh.
And she was brilliant. And I had to turn everything I taught upside down for her because she had to plan it in order to feel it.
Mm.
She couldn't feel it until she'd laid it all out.
When you say digital, you mean like a technical? Or
It's like, almost like
a computer. How did you translate that in before? Yeah.
If I take this image and stick it next to this image, then therefore that will mean this. And then
so
this,
almost mathematical.
It's almost a mathematical way of thinking. Yeah. And we all try to do it with outlining, right?
Yeah.
So because all the gurus that, you know, most of them are not screenwriters. The most famous ones are not screenwriters. And so all this teaching is taught as if it were school, right?
Right.
As if it was math. And you gotta, what's the purpose of the scene? And
module number one.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And formula and all this stuff that really just guarantees your movie's not getting made. Mm. And so, you know, what am I? Primarily the one that comes easy to me. I'm primarily kinesthetic. I feel if it's right or wrong.
Mm.
And secondarily, I'm a visual. Those are the two that come easiest to me, which means if I'm having a tough day, I'm going to go inside and look at my feelings, right? I'm going to go inside. You can see I'm visualist. Well, because I said look at my feelings.
Well, that don't get me started on metaphors. That's part of what I study. Everything that we communicate is about, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I see what you mean. Yeah. Like it's all like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go, if I'm having a rough day, I'm going to go inside to a feeling because that's my easiest way of learning. Mm. If you're primarily auditory, you might need to just put on some music that makes you feel like whatever the feeling you need to write or that sounds like your script. And if you're visual, you might need to go look at some art, or you might actually do an outline, but it probably should be on, you know, on note cards so that you could see it laid out for you. So if you know your primary modality, on a good day, you want to go with on a tough day, you want to go with your mode. On a good day, you want to explore outside your mode. So you want to focus, and it's kind of like lifting weights, right? It's not going to give you an instant bang.
And it'll make you sore.
Yes, yeah. And it will make you sore. But you might just want to practice listening,
yeah,
right? Just really noticing all the sounds around you if you're not very strong auditorially. And don't worry about trying to, you know, write good dialogue. That's not going to help you. But you might want to listen to two of your characters and notice how one talks slightly different than the other. And so you want to spend your good days working to build your skills. On your rough days, you want to go where you're already strong, so that you're always kind of moving forward.
So some of what you've said, I think, also translates into, and we've had discussions before about genre on this show. And I know that what I find valuable, especially since there are so many genres are all kind of melting together. And when, so you're talking about how poetry lets you go inside. When I teach poetry, part of what I do is I disallow that. I say you can only, you have to write your feelings, but, or we do scenes where you can only say what the person is doing or saying. I do a scene, the doing dishes exercise.
Yeah.
So where it's like shared activity and stuff. And even from like before, I think and this is another thing that I notice with my students, in a way, everyone is always inside all the time. It's like, let's talk about feelings. I relate to this. I feel like the world is like this. I think the whole idea of looking and listening and feeling is important for every genre. I think everything needs to start there with incorporating the world and allowing yourself to be part of something bigger instead of just sticking with like diary writing, which is what a lot of students want to do.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also why writing makes us better people, right? Mm-hmm. It when we actually look.
I don't know. A lot of writers are assholes. Sorry.
A lot of anybody are assholes. But
the practice of writing
develops
empathy, and it's supposed to develop that sense of other yourself and the other. You know, demarginalize others. You know,
depends where you're coming from, right?
Yeah.
If you're coming, a lot of writers come from a place of ego.
Right. Yeah.
Right. They're not writing because they're trying to tell some truthful story.
Yeah.
They're writing because they want to be the greatest writer of all time.
Or because everything is about them. Yeah. And that's sort of the mode that we're in. And I'm like the old fogey who's like, and social media has so much to do with this.
Yeah.
But the way that students are these days, there's so much about I just want to say what I think instead of this idea of listening and trying to integrate ideas. I think a lot of young writers are coming from a space of almost ego that's almost isolation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, ego's always going to lead you there.
Right.
Right. This is my experience. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I was a young screenwriter, I had a facility. And what I mean by that is it was relatively easy for me to make you feel an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned how to manipulate with my writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very good at having people creating emotions in people, which is very different from what I do now as a writer and very different from what I teach. And my career really took off when I was able to stop manipulating and stop making it about what I could do and start just telling the truth. And I don't mean the literal truth, although, you know, I did work on a lot of true life stories. But, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien never met a hobbit, but he obviously, if you look at Lord of the Rings, right, it's really a book about addiction. And obviously there was some kind of journey in relation to addiction in his life, right? Frodo had a bigger addict eventually has to bite the ring off of Frodo's finger for him to let go of it. And what's really interesting is then he returns to, and this is really missing from the movies, but in the novel, you're halfway through the third book and the ring is gone. And you're like, what the hell is going to happen now?
Uh-huh.
And then you realize actually what's going to happen is Frodo's going to have to go back to the Shire and all the magical creatures are going to leave Middle Earth and he's going to have to deal with real life, you know, post fantasy.
Yeah.
And so now I don't think J.R.R. Tolkien knew that.
Is post fantasy like after grad school?
After grad school, for sure. So, you know, I don't think Tolkien knew I'm going to write a movie or a book. In that case, it was a book about addiction. In fact, J.R.R. Tolkien said that, you know, had said that. Like, he was a linguist, and all he wanted to do was write the language of the elves.
Mm.
But he was pretty convinced that no one would care about the language of the elves. So he decided, what if I take the language of the elves and I stick it into a fantasy?
Yeah.
And, like, all those elvish songs that you skipped over, right, when you read Lord of the Rings, that was actually the point.
Yeah.
And this is
like hiding your broccoli in the dessert or something.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That. Yeah.
But here's the thing is like a bad screenwriting teacher, and most of them are, would have told him or a bad novel writing teacher, and most of them are, would go, take those songs out. They suck. They're not helping the story. They don't drive anything forward. And he would have lost his inspiration.
Yeah.
And, you know, And once he was through that, he was like, okay, no, actually, it's about World War One. I'm a World War One veteran, and it's about World War One. It's about the Great War, right? And then he thought that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
And eventually, it's going to lead you – it's never about the political, even though you think it is. It's always about what the political means to you. It's always about the personal. And the personal is political, and this is how we create political change is by – writing stories where a person is able to see somebody go like, that's me, and take that person on a journey that opens awareness. So that's a long-winded answer to a simple question, but
there's no such thing as a simple question.
That's true. But the concept is you have to tell the truth, and you will never know the whole truth of the thing you're trying to tell, but you have to tell the little bit of truth that you understand right now. And sometimes a little bit of truth is, I don't know why, but I'm interested in the language of the elves, so I'm going to play with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I'm interested in trying to explore World War One through a fantasy story.
Mm.
So I'm going to run with that. I don't know why, but I was on the subway the other day, and this guy said this line, and I can't get it out of my head, and I don't know what it means. Okay, I'm going to start there. Or I saw this image in my dream that I can't make sense of. I'm going to start there. It doesn't matter what door you go through. But it does matter that the door meant something to you.
And I think there's a certain, as a teacher, there's a certain point where you talk about craft and you give examples and you give exercises. But at a certain point, it's all you can say is, and then something happens. right? And then if you keep doing this, if you keep writing this, something will happen. I don't know what it'll be because it's your thing and not my thing. But if you keep exploring and going into something, eventually some experience happens on the page. And it'll be different for your reader than it is for you, but there's going to be life to it.
Well, it depending on the student, because for some students, that's going to block them, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of students feel very scared about plot, right? And mm-hmm. they feel like, I'm not good at plot. And so for a student who feels comfortable with plot, okay.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about plot. I'm talking about any idea at all, because this goes for poetry, too.
Sure.
This is, yeah.
So, you know, in screenwriting, mm-hmm. what we do is instead of saying something happens because something happens for a student who's already kind of found their voice, mm-hmm. something happens like the opening, like the greatest door ever, mm-hmm. right? Like something happens. Great. It can be anything. I just have to get curious. Mm-hmm. For a writer with a strong internal censor, you need to help them allow something to happen that's going to help move the story forward. Mm-hmm. And so what I usually say is a character is just like you. They're going to enter the scene with a want, mm-hmm. right? There's something that they want, and they want it badly because that's just psychology. You and I entered this room with wants, right? You show up to Starbucks with strong wants, and underneath that want, there's even more primal stuff going on, right? That's like that the respect that you get from the cashier at Starbucks feels like life and death for us. So your character is going to enter just like any other person with their wants hot. The only difference is in movies, because we only have 100 pages to get characters through a big journey, those wants are going to be amplified. And the character is going to move towards their wants more quickly than we do. We wait like 10 years and then we do what we want. Characters in movies wait like 10 seconds and go for what they want. And so what we build towards is choice. We go, okay, let your character enter with a want. I don't care what happens. Just make it hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they will be forced to make a new choice. And it doesn't matter what the choice is. It matters that they make a choice they haven't made before.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, for me, this is where screenwriting and life start to match up.
Yeah.
Right? Is if you want to go on a journey of change, just like your characters need to go on a journey of change, what you need to do is, and it doesn't matter what that thing, it can be big or small, but you eventually have to make a choice you haven't made before. And if you keep making little choices you haven't made before, eventually those choices end up adding up to a big journey.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually that big journey ends up adding up to a theme. And I agree with you, like, something happens is actually saying the same thing.
Yeah, no, yeah. And in terms of, I'm not talking so much about plot or action. I'm saying that at a certain point in writing, you can't technique it anymore. You just have to put something down and you have to go forward.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, like, there's, you know, we can try to use literary devices. We can try to use outlines. But then you actually have to write the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's something that really driving force that pushes you through it, that want, that desire. So, Jacob, I'll ask you this. If your life were a movie, if your life up to this point from birth till now or this point, what would you say? And you touched a little bit in the beginning for those people who are tuning in from the beginning. But what would be the driving force? Is it changed or how has it evolved or what would be the want?
Well, this is such a great question.
Yeah. What do you want in life? Little question.
Well, it's funny. I did a podcast maybe about a year ago called A Trip to Cambodia, where I actually break down a version of my life as a movie to show people how to build a story out of life.
Yeah.
But this is the truth. I can tell the story of my life in 200 different ways.
Yeah.
And it depends upon whatever theme is hot for me right now. So
which truth are you going to focus on?
That's right. And that's why, don't worry, you have a million stories in you. Because so I could tell my story just in relationship to my desire for love.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you about losing my puppy dog at age 5, which is true. He went to live on the farm because he was a bad dog. And I
boarding school.
I loved him. He was my only friend. right? And I could tell you about like the little hole that that opened in my heart and writing probably 30 pieces about that I didn't even know were about that dog until like years of therapy later, right? And I could build from there to every love relationship that I've had, right? And tell my story in terms of like,
love's a bitch.
How do you build? Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. How do you build love when you feel like from childhood, like you're gonna lose whatever you love, right? And I could tell you that story, and I could take plot events from my life and build it around that story. Or I could build my same story. I could tell you that I was a little boy who wanted to be a lawyer. In fact, I wanted to put wood paneling in my bedroom so it would look more like a law office. Okay. I had no creative desires whatsoever. In fact, my sister was the artist. She was an opera singer, and I actually have the only Jewish mother in history who found out her daughter was going to be a doctor and was like, oh, but you could have been an opera singer. But yeah. I could tell you that story, and I could tell you the story of how I discovered that I was an artist, and actually through a love story, I fell in love with a person that I didn't want to be in love with, and she was an artist, and she opened my world, and she also knocked me off course, and I went on a big
journey.
You made
a choice you didn't make
before. I made a choice that I'd never made before, exactly, and I went on a journey, and I learned that I was an artist, and I could tell you about going to Dartmouth and thinking, oh my God, look at these crazy people in the theater department. They are spending 40 grand a year to learn something that's going to pay them 10 grand a year. That's crazy. Yeah. That was me as a freshman at Dartmouth. And by the time I was a senior, I was one of them. And by the time I was 30, I was giving up my career to pursue that. And so I could tell you the same story in relation to that.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody could tell you their story in relation to their mother. So I could tell you my story in relation to my mom.
Uh-huh.
There are a million ways. I just did a newsletter for my students that told the story in relation to my brand new puppy that I just got. So you can tell your story in a million different ways. But you notice that each of them starts with either like a blessing or a wound, right? Mm. And each of them starts with a character who wants something.
Yeah.
And when you start to think that way, you realize that plot is not that hard. That plot is just the crap that happens to happen to you in your life.
Mm.
That the actual structure of your movie or your novel or your memoir is really just choice. It's a choice that you make in relation to whatever happens to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That actually gives the meaning to the story.
And going with that whole idea of focusing on a want and focusing on individual choices, do you ever feel, and this is something that I sort of observe in my students, and I'm wondering what you think about it, they have a hard time figuring out what to leave out. So the idea of focus on something, they want to tell all the stories at once.
Yeah. Mm. I'm sure you have a lot of great thoughts about this too. Like, there are so many different doors you can use for that. One of the tricks that I use is I think of writing as happening in four phases. Because everyone's trying to do everything all at once all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say the first draft is the me draft. And my mantra during the me draft, I'm going to be a little crass, but my mantra is fuck the audience. Yeah. Because if I'm worried about the audience, I'm going to go back to that manipulating place. And I'm going to lose track of the truth. So I'm not worried about the audience. I'm not worried about the producer. I'm not worried, can I sell it? I'm not worried about my mom. I'm not worried about anybody.
There are times in your life when you're not worried about your mom. I think everybody's always worried about their mom.
I say, no, I cannot. Even if she reads this and she's hurt, I have to just write what I see, hear, and feel. I have to write whatever comes to me. Now, and a lot of people misunderstand when I talk about the me draft because they think, oh, it must be like just the vomit pass, you know. But no, the me draft might be 10 drafts, and you probably are going to need a good guide to help you get it out because it's the hardest draft. Everything after that's just craft.
Yeah.
That's just having the right tools at the right time. And a good teacher can lead you towards the tool you need to use, even if you don't know it yourself. But the me draft, that's the hard part, right? That's where you get the raw material that you can shape later. So I go, okay, in the me draft, it depends on who me is right now, right? So if right now I'm, like with the Matthew Shepard story, all I wanted, my me draft, I wanted mom to call her son. That was the only thing I wanted. I didn't think that I could get dad. I didn't think that I could get dad to watch a movie about this issue. But I thought I could get mom to call her gay son or her gay daughter. I thought I could, if I could get mom to call, right? Not the bad mom, because you're not going to get her, but the mom who is trying to be a good mom, but is estranged from her child. I thought if I can just get mom to call. And so my me draft was about, like, if I was mom, what would it take for me to pick up the phone?
Mm-hmm.
And taking myself on that journey through Judy.
And yeah. So you're saying that the me draft is also learning you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this whole, and it's funny, like, write what you know doesn't mean write about yourself necessarily. It means discover
discover what you know.
Right.
It seems like also it's about being authentic to your voice, being authentic to the truth of the screenplay, the truth of the circumstances. I mean, some people might think when you say that story, might think, oh, just make her call. You're the god of the screenplay. You can just make her call. But what I'm hearing also is that the authenticity of being true to the character, being true to the circumstances, the imaginary circumstances.
Yeah,
right?
Like what will make...
will make her call?
Trying things out.
Yeah, right. Will really make it organically true. Yeah.
Yes, and in the movie, which is interesting, she never calls. She actually... Because that wasn't Judy's problem. Judy was a really beautiful mom. Like, but her problem was that they kind of had a don't ask, don't tell policy.
Yeah.
And when I spoke to Judy, you know, and Dennis, who are two really amazing, brave people, you know, she was incredibly honest, and she felt like she, at the time before her son was killed, she thought she was a good mom. You know, her son was gay, and they loved him, and, you know, they thought he was great. It was just kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy. And it was only later that she realized that she felt like she was tolerating her child rather than embracing him. Mm. And so what I needed to do, and this was my me draft on that particular project, was a little bit intellectual, right? But it was, I need to figure out how do you take someone who thinks they're embracing but is actually tolerating and torture them enough?
Mm-hmm.
That they eventually realize that they wish they embraced. And
right.
How is she going to embrace him after his death in a way that she couldn't while he was alive?
Yeah.
And that's the story. And that's what we built. But like, I have a play called Talon that's about my stepbrother. And that piece is, it just started with like, there's this person in my life that I don't understand. And he's the only person in the world that I, at the time, we get along now, but at the time we weren't getting along. And he's like the only nut I couldn't crack. And so it just started with that question for me.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's an image, you know, I got this image in my dream. I don't know what it, but the me draft is like whatever comes, that's what it is. And then it's learning how to focus in. And this is the trick. So you were talking about, I'm trying to tell every story at once.
Right.
Most writers, when they get scared, they get additive.
Yes. Mm.
So instead of, in an improv sense, instead of saying yes and, they say and also.
Oh, yeah.
So most writers get additive as soon as they get scared, like because they think their story isn't good enough, or they think whatever image they have, or that image that came, or that line of dialogue, it's not good enough, because deep down they feel like they're not good enough. And so it's about, the me draft is actually about, how do you learn how to look at what you have already written that you think is crap? How do you learn to see the beauty?
See what's inside of it.
That's
instead
right.
of just trying to explain and summarize your idea, like to see what the heart of it is.
Yes, what is already in there that is already beautiful and truthful that nobody but you could already have said. And you find that thing, and then it's about learning the techniques that you need in order to build from that, so that the next thing is related to that as opposed to additive.
Oh.
And this is what keeps you focused. And this is why the me draft, like, you know, ProTrek is our mentorship program. Like, the me draft is where we work the hardest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It is, yeah. is because the fear of the writer is always going to pull them out. And so you need that person. You need that person who has done it before and who has that right temperament to go. And it sounds like you do the same for your students, right? To go, okay, you have to come back here. No, it's not about adding. It's not about what happens next. It's actually about what's already happened.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? And what's the furthest from there that we could go? And what's a different way to use that image? And what's the opposite of that line? And so learning those techniques that we need to build organically from that. Mm-hmm. And that's the first phase of writing. And by the time you're done that, if you really do that right, you'll have worked your ass off and you'll have cried your ass off. Even if you're
frustrated
writing a comedy,
yourself.
And frustrated yourself. But now you have raw material that's worth shaping. And it's going to be a mess most of the time.
Well, writing is messy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's another thing that in school, in college at least, people lose sight of. Yeah. You have all of these like learning objectives and stuff, and then the evaluations that the student fill out. And writing is messy. It's a messy process.
Yeah.
But one thing I want to also bring up is what I'm hearing from all this conversation is that, you know, when we're trying to be truthful, that, you know, and we're talking about the facts that things happened and, you know, when you talk about the Matthew Shepard story and such, that certain events happen and they're just cold, hard facts, you know? And then you want to tell a story that you were telling the story about how you wanted the mother to call, but in fact, she didn't call, right? That's what I understood. Yeah. That in the
well,
true
she,
story,
it wasn't
the
her problem.
Story,
she, in the movie, yeah. there's no big moment where she calls.
Yeah.
Because. Okay. Because she was always talking to him.
Oh, okay.
She was.
Yeah.
It was the problem. The problem was, what's the difference between tolerating and embracing?
Yeah.
And the problem of parents thinking that they're embracing when actually they're tolerating.
Yeah.
And so what Judy hadn't done, and this is really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So and because we get caught up in the idea of truth. And it's, you have to be very careful as a teacher, because if you push too hard, people will get literal.
Yeah, that's
so
what I was kind of getting at, yeah.
When I met Judy, so for those of you who don't know, Matthew Shepard was tied to a fence and beaten to death for being gay, a truly horrible hate crime. And when I met Judy, she had not yet gone to the fence where her son was killed. That was a big deal. And we talked about it. And she was like, I just can't go. And so John Wyrick, who I wrote Matthew Shepard with, and I, we talked about it. And we were like, if she doesn't go to the fence in our movie, then the movie becomes about not going to the fence.
Right.
And so we asked ourselves, well, literally she hasn't gone yet. Do I believe that she will go someday? Yes, I do. Mm. Number two, has she gone metaphorically if she hasn't gone literally? Mm. And I realized, yes, this woman goes to the fence every single day, yeah. right? She lives at that fence. She is wrestling with what happened to her son in full public view every single day of her life. And so metaphorically, I felt she had gone. And so John and I went to the fence. And what was really surprising, we got to the fence. And the fence is, you know, we imagined like a fence. But the fence is one link of fence. It is about 8 feet long. It doesn't block anything. It doesn't mark anything. It looks like someone built a link of fence just for someone to be tied to. Mm. It is, and then we're walking towards this fence, and I look up, and I realize we're in the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And I looked at John, and I said, it's beautiful. I didn't expect that. And we're both crying. And so that was the truth for me. And so I do, in my movie, I do send Judy to the fence, and I give her my line. And she says to Dennis, who also had not been to the fence yet, she says, it's beautiful. I didn't expect that. And that's the moment where she actually reconnects.
Where she calls her son.
That's the moment where she calls her son. Yeah. Exactly right. And it's also the moment where she has to actually deal with, for real, the horror of what happened and see if she can come through the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the horror of what happened to him physically, but the horror of what happened to their relationship. Mm. And it was kind of amazing after that movie. My friend Mary called me up and she's like, I'm in New Jersey and I just watched the movie with a bunch of friends, and one of my friend's phone rang and it was her mom calling him. And I was like, my movie has been successful. whatever yeah. pain I went through writing it. And so these are not literal things that we're doing. They're yeah. emotional things that we're doing. But if it doesn't feel truthful, it is not going
to
work.
And you also, it seems like you're saying that you have to work through figuring out whether it's going to be an event or a metaphor.
Yeah.
And trying it and working, struggling through that.
Yeah. Well, I would say every event's a metaphor.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For us, we mm-hmm. take the plot that happens to happen in our lives and we attach meaning to it.
Yeah, just Joan Didion said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live.
That's
yeah.
right.
So yeah. you're going to have to come back on the show and tell us about those other three phases of writing, because we only yeah. got through the
I would
first
love
one.
To do that. Or people could come check out my class, and I'd love to tell them about them.
Yeah,
do you want to share
yeah.
your website?
Yeah, website, yeah.
Or
so yeah, our website is writeyourscreenplay.com, and I have a four-week Write Your Screenplay class that's starting up in a couple weeks, if you want to learn about the four phases of writing and a lot more. Really,
so this is a teaser.
If you want to learn how to build an organic structure for your character and for your life as an artist, that's really what we learn in that class.
Yeah. Also, the podcast you have where you analyze different movies, I believe.
Yeah. So I have a podcast called the Write Your Screenplay Podcast. What we do is we look at a different movie each episode, and instead of ranking it two thumbs up or two thumbs down or loved it or hate it, which always drives me crazy, what we do is, whether it's a great movie or a mess, we look at it as if it were an early draft. And we mm-hmm. think about what can we learn from it as a writer. Yeah. And so a lot of our movies are going to be bad movies before they become good movies. And so the podcast is basically, we don't judge, we don't care. I don't care if it's good or bad. I try to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have a strong emotional reaction to it, even if the strong emotional reaction is I hate this, or I'm politically outraged, which I feel often, you want to look at, like, okay, well, what's actually beautiful about this that mm-hmm. I could build yeah. on? And then what tools would I need to build? So you can access that on iTunes if you iTunes search for Write Your Screenplay, or on my website if I have a whole transcript of every episode. We have over 100.
And just check out rockawaywritersworkshop.org. Our classes are going to be starting not this week, but the week after. So you can get a full description of what our next session. It's called the Obsession Sessions.
Great. So this is Radio Free Brooklyn, the Truth to Power show. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community and promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations from listeners like you. So to help support our mission, we invite you to make a one-time donation or monthly pledge at readyforbrooklyn.org/donate. Every cent helps us continue to stay on air. So please support independent community media by pledging whatever you can afford. All contributions are tax deductible to the full extent of law. Again, that's readyforbrooklyn.org/donate. Thanks so much, guys. And if you're listening to the program on your computer, free yourself up by going to the mobile apps by readyforbrooklyn.org/iPhone or Android, and you'll be able to listen to the show on the go. Go to truthpower.org, truthpower.com, truthpower.podomatic.com, and you can find our archives there. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To the wire on that.
Yeah.
Everybody Plays the Fool features a wide variety of music with a different theme each week. Check out the archive at